This talk was recorded at Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society in Los Angeles and is freely offered for your enjoyment. For more information, please visit againstthestream.org.
For tonight, I wanted to talk a bit this evening about what is a very traditional topic, and in some ways, many would say the beginning of one's commitment to Buddhist practice. And probably not actually the beginning for most of us, but that it's an important sort of ritual or a way to think about Buddhism that will occur at some point in your studies of Buddhism. And they are the three refuges. This experience of taking refuge in what is sometimes called the three jewels or the three pillars or the three core tenets of Buddhism, which are the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. I just want to talk about taking refuge tonight. So first, seems interesting and important to have some level of definition of this term refuge. It's not a term that most of us use very often, I don't think. What's it mean to you when you think, just reflect for a moment, refuge? What's it mean to take refuge or to be in a refuge or a refugee? A what? Place of safety. Say, like protection from something.
Shelter. Freedom from fear.
A refuge could be a freedom, a safety, or a freedom from fear.
Guidance. Yes.
Guidance. Refuge could be guidance.
Sanctuary.
Sanctuary. So, of course, all of these things, probably and more, taking refuge. Clearly, a place of safety, but then again, defining from what? From fear, someone said. Of course, Buddha is always interested in freedom from suffering. And all of Buddhism and the kind of core of the teachings and the path is, how can we end our suffering? How can we find freedom, safety, protection from suffering and the causes of suffering? What will give us a refuge from the suffering in this world and in this body and this mind? So refuge from suffering. In the form of the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha. So taking refuge in the Buddha, I think, can be a little bit confusing, especially for us non-religious minded people, and because it can sound a little bit like you're sort of accepting baby Jesus, baby Buddha to be your Lord and Savior. I take refuge in the Buddha, and it can feel a little... Yeah, right? It can feel a little like a prayer or like a external. So it's interesting, you know, the Buddha's saying, take refuge in the Buddha. Now, to define Buddha, not necessarily the historical person, but Buddha just is a word that means awakening. So I think it's important to say we're not turning our life over or taking refuge in a personality. In a person, but in the potential for awakening, in Buddhahood, in the potential to be awake. And of course, what is thought is that that's in all of us, that there is a Buddha potential inside of you, inside of each one of us. And so taking refuge not in someone else, finding a place of safety not out there, but in this mind-body-heart process, finding solace, finding safety, finding protection in the fact that it is possible in this lifetime to be awake, therefore free from suffering. And so taking refuge, I feel like, is a commitment to doing the hard work necessary to awaken. And that it's not some sort of external saying, well, now Buddha, help me. Help me wake up. It's not about any sort of external Buddha. Even when the Buddha was alive, he was saying, take refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha, and people would bow to him. They'd bow to the personality. But he was quite clear, it is not me that you're taking refuge in. It is the truth. It is your own potential. On his deathbed, Siddhartha Gautama, the historical Buddha, on his deathbed, the monks and nuns were gathering around, and they were sort of freaking out a little bit. And they were wanting him to name a sort of a successor and a lineage. And there was all of these people that had been with him for his whole life, for 40, 50 years of his teaching career. And they were sort of saying, like, okay, now you're dying, who's in charge? And he said, it sounds like, you know, the way that I read it is like he was shaking his head. And he was saying, you're so confused if you think that you need someone else to be in charge. You're still looking outside of yourself. You're still looking for someone to do the work for you, to And he said something like, paraphrasing, something like, do not seek an external refuge. So that's really important for this whole process, that his dying words, one of the last things he thought it was important to leave for us, is that reminder, do not seek an external refuge. And he said, be a lamp or a guide to yourself. Or shine the light of awareness inward. Be a lamp, a guide unto yourself. That everything you're looking for is in here. Look, shine the light inward. And be diligent, something about tread forward diligently, and you'll find everything you're looking for, something like that. But do not seek a refuge in the Buddha as some external refuge. Seek an internal refuge. Seek the Buddha within, for lack of a better word, rather than outside of us. So in that first refuge that is very traditional, is saying, okay, I'm coming to Buddhism, I want to wake up, I want to understand, I want to be more wise, more compassionate, more generous, more kind, forgiving, whatever it is, happy, whatever your motivation for meditating like this is. The first refuge is a commitment to finding that through your own direct experience, through your own direct effort, from within. Refuge in the Buddha. Does that make sense? Any comments or questions about that first refuge before we move on? I like to break it down into three pieces rather than doing the whole talk. I guess part of the question is here is kind of what level of confidence do we have in our own potential? And I guess that's where the historical character comes in, is that part of what it is that he's saying, I did this and so can you. You can use me as an example, and it's where our mentors, our teachers, people ahead of us on the path come in, as maybe some level of an external support, inspiration. Because often we feel like, oh, I can't do that. Our low self-esteem, our doubting mind, our comparing tendency says, well, there's no Buddha in here. I've looked. It's full of shit. Selfishness. Fear. But actually having some confidence in our innate potential. Please.
Is it analogous to the Christian idea that the kingdom of heaven is within?
Sounds good to me. I have no idea, though, because I don't know where that quote comes from or what's the context of it, but sounds like that, maybe. I don't know, I could get into all kinds of thoughts about, well, what exactly is heaven and the kingdom of heaven? Because when the Buddha is saying, oh, you have the potential to be awake, he's saying that nirvana, that you can be awake to the pleasure and pain in your life and not suffer about it. Now, I think most of our ideas, which means that there's still pain. Is there pain in heaven? So that's why I say I don't really know, because if the kingdom of heaven is within and that means that you can come to a place in this life where you only experience pleasure and have a heavenly type of experience and no pain, then that's clearly not what the Buddha is talking about. He's talking about being awake to life as it is, with its joys and its sorrows, its ups and downs, its moments of heaven and its moments of hell. And that's what it means to be awake, I believe. Which I think is different than most traditions in Hindu and Christian. And I think in most theistic traditions, there's some ultimate idea that you will have good times all the time. And I think that really clearly the Buddha's experience was not good times all the time. Freedom all the time. Not laying an extra level of difficulty on top of the situation all the time. But not that it's always going to feel good. Not that we're not going to still experience some grief, some difficult emotions. Or physical pain. We're still going to stub our toe. Do you stub your toe in heaven? I don't know. Do you slam your fingers in the car door in heaven? So in that way, I like to think that we're pointing towards something similar, that it's an inside job, but the actual philosophy of the outcome may be different. Yeah.
I feel an urge to share this from, I think it's from a Pema Chodron tape,
sure,
where she talks about not having someone outside of ourselves to look to. It's like we no longer can go home and say, I'm home, and the refrigerator will be full of cookies and, you know, all of the goodies or whatever. There's nobody there to say, I'm home. It has to be from in here. And I think for a lot of people who've gotten used to thinking there's someone or something or some deity or whatever, it's kind of a loss initially to,
sure,
not have that.
It's really a security blanket to believe that there's an external refuge. Makes us feel safe, right? And it's very, it's out there and it'll take care of me and it'll... And I feel good and protected and a full refrigerator. And yeah, it can be really pulling the carpet out from under us. I think it's what Alan Watts was pointing towards when he said, you know, Buddhism is teaching the wisdom of insecurity. As having no external refuge, as having no external security, and walking the without a net. There's no sort of... Now, this having been said, this is my interpretation of the Buddha's original teachings, and I'll tell you that I believe that 90% of Buddhists, maybe more, when they take refuge in the Buddha, they're thinking that the external Buddha is going to protect them. And they're completely ignoring the Buddha's word. They probably don't even know that the Buddha said, don't seek an external refuge. Because that's the problem with religion. And that there's that core human desire to be protected, to be cared for, to create a God where there isn't one. And make Buddha into a god. Now, let's make golden statues, and let's bow to him, and let's pray to him, and rub his belly. It'll give you good luck. Because we feel so uncomfortable with being uncomfortable, with being insecure, that then we turn even somebody who said, this is not my teaching. I do not wish you to seek an external refuge. And we turn him into, oh, well, yep, he's the man. Pray to him.
It's part of this teaching that every person has the potential to...
100%. That there is no, she said, is part of this teaching that every person has the potential to awaken. And that is 100% of this. This teaching, taking refuge in the fact that you can get enlightened, wake up, be free from suffering. There is no lack of ability in any living being. Every living being has the ability. Whether or not we have the willingness to do the hard work to free ourselves from whatever delusions are covering our Buddha nature, for lack of a better word, our awakened potential. Whether we are willing to do the work, that's a different story. Everyone can. Very few will, is the thought. No lack of ability, only a lack of willingness. So, move on a little bit to taking refuge in the Dharma. Dharma can be translated a couple different ways. Often we talk about the Buddha's Dharma, it's his teachings. It's the closest translation is truth. But there's Hindu Dharma, right? So there's the Hindu truth. There's the Buddha's Dharma. There's the Buddha's truth. We could call the Bible Christian Dharma. The truth according to the Christians. But what's supposed to be pointed to here is that there is a universal truth. That there is a truth that will be revealed to anyone that looks deeply. That the Dharma will be revealed right here in your own mind and body. All of the truth. Last week we talked about the three core tenets. We could call the three core tenets of the Dharma. Three characteristics of existence. Everything's impermanent. Because of impermanence, there's a unsatisfactory quality to both pleasure and pain, because it all is passing quickly. And ultimately, there's a level of impersonal nature to much of what we experience, this mind, this body, this lifetime. Those three characteristics are universal Dharma. anybody from any philosophy that looks carefully will see that this is true. There is no kind of disputing it. It's not a belief system. It's the way it is what Dharma is supposed to be. But of course, different perspectives will say, no, this is definitely the way it is. This is definitely the way it is. So I think what's most important here isn't belief systems, isn't philosophy, isn't Buddhism or any other religion, but is the potential for experiencing the truth, awakening to the truth, ourselves. And that we're not believing, we're not taking anything on blind faith, we're not signing up for to be another follower of some religion or to take refuge in someone else's truth. But it, just like the first refuge in your potential for awakening, refuge in the fact that you can experience the truth for yourself. And that in some ways you don't even need a guide or a interpreter for the truth. Remember, the Buddha was not a Buddhist. He just sat down. He just did intensive meditation. He came to these experiences out of his own investigation. He wasn't taking refuge in someone else's teachings. He was more of a scientific explorer of his own mind, an investigator. What's going on in here? What's making me tick? What's causing suffering? What works to end suffering? Oh, if I'm more kind, if I'm more compassionate, more generous, I suffer less. Less attached, I suffer less. So all of that is the Dharma. These are the truths revealed in our own heart-mind process. Make sense? Also part of what is the truth is that, from this perspective, is that there's all of this biological survival instinct of greed and hatred, delusion, what we call the three poisons, which are covering our Buddha nature and the Dharma, that are obscuring or blocking our ability to see clearly the wise heart, the compassionate heart. And that is also Dharma. It is also true. These poisons that are in all of us, that are the sort of survival instinct gone awry, and the wisdom, the acceptance that we're not born to be happy. Happiness is not our birthright. You don't get to be happy just because you took birth as a human being. Is that pretty clear at this point? I mean, happy all the time and kind of sustained well-being. We don't get it just, well, I'm a human. Okay, where's my fucking happiness? I want my inheritance. Actually, our inheritance as we take this form is a form that craves pleasure. And that instinct for craving pleasure gets so out of whack, we become greedy for pleasure. And then we become greedy for material things. And then we think material things are going to make us happy because we mistake pleasure for happiness. And then we wage war on our neighbors because we think they have more than we do and we want their stuff or their oil or their land or their... And it's that core survival instinct that causes all of the problems in this world because it's not related to wisely, correctly. We don't have renunciation around it. We're addicted to our mind. We're addicted to our desires. We do whatever our mind and instinct tells us to. We live like animals most of the time. So, refuge in the Dharma is knowing that actually there's a place in here that knows better. There's a truth in here that knows it's better to give than to get. It's better to be kind than angry. It's better to be compassionate than hateful. That these are the truths that end suffering, that will be revealed from our own direct experience, if we train our heart and mind in the right way, and if we look deeply into to ourselves. So taking refuge in the Dharma. We could also say that there's something about the Eightfold Path, the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, as the core teachings of the Buddha that lead us to experiencing this truth for ourselves. So there's something important about that external map that says, you know, if you want to be happy, be mindful, learn to concentrate. Be careful with your sexuality, with your speech, with your livelihood. Study and come to the right understanding and make sure you have the right intentions. There's something important about having a map, but what's more important is that that map is directing us back towards ourselves, not somewhere else. The Eightfold Path is all turning us back towards revealing a truth from within. Anything about the Dharma before we go on to the Sangha, refuge in the Dharma?
One question, I don't know if it's very related or not, but what is the Buddha's teaching on surrender and release? Would that be a truth that in this life, like, we're not in charge, basically, and by surrendering and releasing our wants, maybe we can reduce our suffering?
Are you talking about surrendering and releasing to something, or just the act of letting go?
The act of letting go, it's like sometimes, I mean, I've experienced in my life that no matter what I do, and I put my 200%, like, I'm not in charge. It seems like I can't control things. I can't control the way that my life is, you know, it's heading. So, and I've been told, like, I was practicing Hinduism for a while, and they were telling me, you gotta do surrender. You just gotta surrender that you're not in, you know, full charge, and then that will, you know, help you to live, you know, easier. That, you know, there's like these, you know, cosmic energy or whatever, you know, that is actually in charge, and then when, you know, things are right, you know, things would happen. So basically, you just surrender and believe that things would be taken care of, basically.
There's some connections to that in Buddhism, but it's not quite the same. There's a lot of emphasis being put on letting go of trying to control impermanent phenomena. Like, we tend to cling to pleasure, or we tend to push away pain, and that's a form of trying to control something that I think you're pointing to, that it's just, it's out of, we can't control impermanence. It's like trying to fight gravity or the tide, or it's just, it's impossible. There isn't a kind of cosmic energy that's going to take care of it, as in a theistic tradition like Hinduism. Instead, there is the karma, which is everyone has their own personal responsibility, and that we are sort of co-creating, based on how we relate to what's happening in our life, our future. It's not fatalistic, it's not just fate, it's not destiny. There's a personal creation that we are in charge on some level of our happiness, not the circumstances that come into our life, but how we respond to them through how we positive, negative actions, karmic momentum. But ultimately, from a Buddhist perspective, there is no cosmic energy that we can let go to. Now, I've thought about this a lot because I'm in recovery, and in recovery they have a deep tradition of saying let go, let God, which is a bit like that. And so I've sort of thought, okay, well, what's my Buddhist equivalent to that? And it's just let go. You don't have to assign it to a cosmic energy or an external deity, but the act of letting go stops suffering. That surrender that you're talking about, just letting go. There's not a comforting philosophy of somebody's going to catch you. It's just let go. Into the insecurity of the unknown. Free falling without a net. With the understanding that there is that it's safe to free fall without a net.
You know, as one of my teachers likened that exact context, what he was saying earlier about, you know, this dialogue's happening, cascading while he's watching the breath. It's that letting go is just the same practice as watching. It's over and over and over again of just letting go. It's not like surrender.
Right.
Medicinal.
And when it's impermanent like that, letting go is just letting it be the way it's supposed to be. And so then sometimes actually using the term let it be is better. Because I know for myself, once in a while when I'm attached to something and I'm telling myself to let it go, there's an aversion. It's not a surrender. It's not just a letting go. It's a, I'm going to let you go away from me right fucking now. On my terms and on my timeline. And it's not just a gentle, I'm going to surrender to this and let it be impermanent. It's just this, you know, semantically I see a difference in my own practice around when I let something be and I try to let go of it.
Now, a minute ago you were talking about karma or karmic law and things happening and co-creation, and there was this discussion perhaps of an entity or a thing. Let's not call it an entity, let's not personify it, but is there a Buddhist understanding of this underpinning, this emptiness that form arises from, that some might want to call or label God, for lack of a way of understanding what this, you know, this underneath supporting or a background fuzz or something. Where's this emptiness go? Where's this karmic co-creation stuff come from and go to, fall back into it?
Rising out of nowhere and dissolving into nothing. So if that nowhere and nothing, that kind of emptiness that you're pointing to, if that's maybe what some people are calling the cosmic energy or the... there is no intelligence to emptiness. Now often with with cosmic energy, it's thought that there's an intelligent design behind it. The emptiness, the shunyata or the anatta of the Buddha's teaching, there's no sort of compassionate, intelligent design to it, or wrathful design to it. It's just the way it is.
Could you say there's infinite potential within it?
Potential for what?
All the form that arises.
Sure. I think so.
I think so.
Yeah.
But wouldn't you say, I mean, that's how I see myself when I meditate, that when I'm meditating, at the very moment that I'm in the moment, I feel empty. Like, I feel like I don't exist. And that emptiness actually is
you
so
don't.
Beautiful. It's full of everything. Like, it has everything in it.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I can't define it, but it's just like,
infinite.
I wish I could have that all the time.
I think it was the Hindu saint Nisargadatta, who's a kind of Advaita, non-dual guy who lived, in this century. And some of my teachers, Jack Kornfield, spent some time with him. Akasa Levy, who teaches here, spent some time with him. He was in Bombay, India. And everybody pretty much thought that he was a pretty, fully enlightened person. And he has a quote that said something like, wisdom tells me that everything is empty. But love tells me that everything is full. Between the two, my life flows. So So maybe it's just kind of what lens? Are we looking through the love lens? Are we looking through the wisdom lens? It looks a little different. Full or empty, and it's exact same reality. Refuge in the Sangha. Now, it makes some sense in this world of greed, hatred, and delusion that Sangha, which means community, that there's some safety in here with like-minded revolutionaries who are also seeking happiness, seeking freedom, that there's some agreed upon commitment in the Sangha to try to be kind, to try to be forgiving, to try to be compassionate, generous. So I think there's something there. I'm not sure how refuge in the Sangha is not an external refuge. I don't quite get that. Right? The Buddha says, seek no external refuge. I get it for the Buddha. I get it for the Dharma. He's talking about it's in here. But Sangha, of course, you're not in here. Maybe you should be in our hearts or whatever. But
could it be the sense of belonging?
Perhaps. No, yeah, being part of. So that it's not just taking refuge in you, but we are belonging together. I also have often reflected on kind of the play of words refuge, refugee, refugee camp. And from what I hear, often it's out of the fire or frying pan and into the fire in these refugee camps. Where, you know, you're leaving the war zone or you're leaving the oppression, and then you're going into this place where they're oppressing and raping and pillaging in the camps. And I think that Buddhist Sangha is a little bit like that sometimes. You know, you're like, it's really fucked out there. This world. Everybody's selfish. Self-centered. Afraid. I'm coming in here. Oh shit, everybody's selfish. Self-centered. Afraid. Just like out there. And I think that there's some truth to that, and that actually that may even be part of our refuge and of our practice of saying that this isn't some idealistic, we're all enlightened, but we're all doing the work together. I had one Buddhist teacher who used the analogy of a rock tumbler for the Sangha and for the refugee of the Sangha. And he said, you know, we come here because we all have jagged edges. And then we get into the community, into the Sangha, and we rub up against each other. And we, you know, are kind of prickly and jagged. And over the years of living together and practicing together and of forgiving each other, of pushing each other's buttons and being imperfect, that here we have the opportunity to take off the mask, to show up and say, I'm fucked up. Are you fucked up? I'm suffering. You suffering? And then smooth out. Let the tumbler, let the community do its work. There are opportunities here for practice rather than let's pretend like nothing's wrong. Let's pretend like we're super spiritual. And my shit does not even smell very bad. Or whatever, to really kind of be real and say, the refuge in the community is a place to be real, and to show up, and to support each other, and to challenge each other.
Also, as opposed to an external belonging, but an acknowledgement that, yes, I'm fucked up, and yes, you're fucked up. Mm-hmm. Not so much are you,
right.
We are.
Right.
And I think from that, forgiveness and compassion is more tangible.
Yeah. The normalizing effect of we're all in it together.
That we are community,
yeah.
And that we are each in,
yeah.
Searching the truth inside,
yeah.
Of each.
Yeah.
And acknowledging the respect to each other.
Yeah.
Thinking about the refuge of the Sangha as being kind of a nice balance to maybe the first two refuges that are very individualistic, very centered on just the individual, and kind of the third is the balancing out that we are part of the community. It's not just one person. There is support, there is help, there is assistance, and it's okay to ask for help. So I see the balance.
Me too. In this world where there's very little support, we don't have to do it alone. And maybe even the acknowledgement that we really actually need each other. There's also something about, it's easy to be really spiritual when you're by yourself in the woods. It's more difficult when you actually have to talk to people and have interactions. And so that there's something about the necessity of that interaction, that actually the Buddha and the Dharma that we're seeking is a relational Buddha and Dharma, not an isolated I'm spiritual when I'm in the cave, but how do I do in conflict? How do I do when somebody's not being, you know, playing right, not behaving the way I think they should, breathing too loud when I'm trying to fucking meditate, or whatever it is, you know? Anyways, these are some reflections on Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, and important to reflect on what your relationship is to your commitment to your own awakening, to your own truth, and to the community, to really being part of. And we have a rare opportunity here. I was talking to somebody recently who's been practicing with us for a couple of years now, but still feeling sort of isolated and feeling like, well, I have a bunch of associates here, but I haven't really gotten to know people. I don't really hang out with people in the Sangha outside of meditation. And I was just telling him about how, you know, almost every day, really regularly, I get these emails from people all over the country who just say, like, I wish I could find people to meditate with that were like-minded, that maybe had a couple tattoos and, you know, didn't listen to the Grateful Dead or whatever it is. I apologize for that one. But all of the time people are saying, like, I just don't have a community, or the, you know, the Buddhists in my town are very religious and they want us to bow and they want us to do this or that, or you have to kind of take the Zen robes or whatever it is. And I just reflect on how fortunate we are to have such a large community of open-minded, cool people that you actually might hang out with even if you weren't meditating, that might actually have be your people on some level. At least some of us in the room, you know, would hang out with each other, and that's an incredible opportunity. And I was reflecting on how often do we not connect with the people in the Sangha because there's something that we like, our ego likes about being the only Buddhist in our inner circle. How often is it sort of an ego trip to say, no, I don't really want to be with peers because then I'll just be part of. I like being the only Buddhist in my, you know, in my circle. And looking at that, and then I might be challenged to grow more if I was really part of, if I really let you know me. If I really let you guys in, then I'd have to show up. So just reflecting on what our commitment to that kind of showing up is. Any other thoughts, questions, or comments before we end? Well, as a totally optional exercise, there is a little ritual we could do around this, around taking refuge. Honestly, if you want to become a Buddhist, how you become a Buddhist is through this ritual. I want to become a Buddhist. You say, I take refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha, boom, you're a Buddhist. That's it. But, you know, and that's the truth. That's the kind of traditional religious structure of Buddhism, is you take the refuges you're then sort of part of. You've committed to the path. But I don't really think of it that way in the religion. I think of much more of it as a commitment to our practice. Not to a religion. Not to Buddhism. But just as a commitment to saying, I want to be awake. I want to live in harmony with the truth. And I know I need some homies to do that with. I need some crew. And so I commit to developing that with you guys. So if you care to, just sitting for a moment and reflecting on these teachings. Reflecting on the Buddha and your own potential for awakening. The Dharma to be revealed within your own heart, mind, and the Sangha. You can just do it in a simple English call and response. I'll say the line, and if you care to, just repeat it. I take refuge in the Buddha.
I take refuge in the Buddha.
I take refuge in the Dharma.
I take refuge in the Dharma.
I take refuge in the Sangha.
I take refuge in the Sangha.
You may notice that we always ring the bell 3 times around here, and so that is always for the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, to remind us of those 3 aspects. Thank you for your presence tonight, for your practice. May we share the merit of these practices and this commitment with every being in existence. May we bring about a positive change to this world through our own actions.
You have just listened to a podcast from Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society. If you'd like to make a contribution to help support these teachings, please visit againstthestream.org.